Hello, this is Dick Estelle. I continue reading the book today called Anatomy of Injustice, written by Raymond Bonner. It was published in 2012 by Alfred A. Knopf Publishers of New York. We have learned that in addition to murder, the grand jury handed up an indictment for criminal sexual conduct, burglary, housebreaking, armed robbery, and larceny against Edward Lee Elmore. The prosecuting attorney was a man named William T. Jones III, and he was well known, very well known, in that area. Now, the court had overturned a conspiracy conviction, in part, on the grounds that the prosecutor had exceeded permissible bounds in his cross-examination. Sutherland, a conservative Republican from Utah, observed that the prosecutor should prosecute with earnestness and vigor, but while he may strike hard blows, he is not at liberty to strike foul ones. It is as much his duty to refrain from improper methods calculated to produce a wrongful conviction as it is to use every legitimate means to bring about a just one. 32 years later, in 1967, Justice Byron White expressed the same view. He wrote in the United States v. Wade, "Law enforcement officers have the obligation to convict the guilty and to make sure they do not convict the innocent." Though appointed by President Kennedy, White was not a liberal on the court and tended to side with the prosecution over the defense. He had, for instance, dissented a year earlier in the case Miranda. The American Bar Association sets the standards and ethical codes for lawyers. "The duty of the prosecutor is to seek justice, not merely to convict," says the ABA's criminal justice standards. But it elaborates by saying, "Although the prosecutor operates within the adversary system, it is fundamental that the prosecutor's obligation is to protect the innocent as well as to convict the guilty, to guard the rights of the accused, as well as to enforce the rights of the public." At the time, Jones was chief prosecutor in Greenwood. His counterpart in Los Angeles, Stephen Trott, was teaching young deputies what this ethical obligation meant. When one of them would come to him and say he was facing an ethical problem because he had discovered evidence that would help the defense, and if he turned it over, the state would lose, Trott would say, "That's not an ethical problem. The ethical answer is easy. Turn it over." Or a deputy would inform his boss that he had concluded his star witness was lying. Trott, who would go on to serve as Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Division of the Justice Department during the Reagan administration, and as a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, would say, "You don't have an ethical problem. You don't have a case. Dismiss it." And that's the pinnacle of a prosecutor adhering to his ethical duty. Mark Kleiman, who had worked for Trott, stated, "I wonder how many of today's senior prosecutors tell their juniors stories like that one." Well, apparently not Jones. After Mrs. Edwards's fingerprints had been taken at SLED headquarters and the hairs found on her body during the autopsy had been examined, the evidence against Elmore was weak at best, and the evidence was stronger that another unknown person may have committed the murder. But the police stopped their investigation once they had arrested Elmore, and Jones, far from dismissing the case, proceeded to trial. Chapter 2. "Justice delayed is justice denied," goes the popular legal maxim, which is traced back to the Magna Carta. But speedy justice can be injustice, too. In Elmore's case, everyone seemed to be in a hurry. Generally, the time between a murder and the opening of a trial is at least a year, and often several. The state has to find evidence, as well as locate and interview witnesses. The defense, lacking the police resources of the state, has an even more difficult job and time-consuming job. But only 84 days after Mrs. Edwards's body was found, the State of South Carolina versus Edward Lee Elmore opened on Monday, April 12, 1982, the day after Easter. It was reported on the front page of the Index Journal, but foreign news dominated that day. The six-column headline over a story out of Jerusalem read, "Strikes, Arab rioting sweep West Bank." Beneath that was a story about the war between the United Kingdom and Argentina over the Falkland Islands. In Washington, D.C., John W. Hinckley, Jr. was about to go on trial for the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan. On the West Coast, Mount St. Helens went quiet after an eruption that had begun 3 weeks earlier. The trial was held in the Greenwood County Courthouse, a sand-colored two-story brick building. In front is a cherry tree donated by Fujifilm when it located its North American headquarters on a leafy campus on the outskirts of the town. The court is located at 528 Monument Street. The monument, for which it is named, sits in the shadow of a magnificent magnolia tree on the south side of the building and is dedicated to, quote, "our Confederate soldiers," unquote. Erected in 1903 by the Ladies Memorial Association of Greenwood County and carefully maintained ever since, the monument consists of a Confederate soldier with his rifle standing atop a Greek column and is almost as tall as the courthouse. And the inscription reads, 1861 to 1865, Patriots, who, animated by the same faith, actuated by the same love of country, beset with the same trials and dangers, endured with the same fortitude, and fought as heroically to maintain local self-government as did the colonial fathers to attain the same, and with them are immortalized in the same halo of glory. The courthouse was built in 1968. An open stairwell leads to a second-floor lobby and the courtroom, which has tall, solid double doors. There are no windows. The interior walls are brick, but the high ceiling gives a feeling of spaciousness. It can hold some 250 spectators on church-like pews divided into three sections. The judge's bench is elevated. Judge E.C. Burnett III, who had just turned 40, intoned, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if you would give me your attention just for a few minutes," and he opened the trial of Edward Lee Elmore. Black-robed and bespectacled, he was flanked on his right by the American flag and on his left by the South Carolina state flag, a banner with a white crescent and a palmetto tree against a deep blue background that was designed for the South Carolina troops who fought the British. Burnett, an avid golfer and devout Christian, was a circuit court judge from Spartanburg, 60 miles northeast of Greenwood. He said, "I've been assigned to Greenwood for a week of General Sessions Court, which is commonly referred to as criminal court." He explained this to the men and women who had been summoned for jury duty. After graduating in 1964 from Wofford College, the small liberal arts school that Dorothy Edwards' husband attended, Burnett served in the Army, including a tour in Vietnam. Following his military service, he earned a law degree from the University of South Carolina and then returned to his hometown, engaged in the private practice of law, and served one term in the South Carolina House of Representatives. He was appointed a probate judge in 1976 and later a family court judge. He would go on to serve 30 years as a judge by the time he retired from the Supreme Court in 2007, a longevity record in South Carolina. He was politically conservative, and he had occasionally allowed his politics to triumph over the discipline expected of judges. Some years after the Elmore trial, he signed an anti-abortion ad, which brought a reprimand from the South Carolina Supreme Court for taking a public stance on an issue that might come before the court. The South Carolina Bar Association rated him least qualified when he was later being considered for a seat on the state Supreme Court. But politics trumped merit. The legislature appoints circuit court judges and Supreme Court justices, and black lawmakers cut a deal. They voted for Burnett for the Supreme Court in exchange for white legislators agreeing to a black judge on the circuit court. While sitting on the High Court, Burnett embroiled himself with another controversy. His daughter, a Spartanburg schoolteacher, sent him an email that mocked blacks. The subject was vocabulary words. A student named Leroy is asked to use the words in a sentence. AFRO, I got so mad at my girl. AFRO, a lamp at her. Kenya, I needed money for the subway, so I ax a stranger Kenya spare some change. Dimension, I be tall, dark, handsome, and dimension smart. There were 18 examples in all. And Burnett told the State, that's the Columbia's largest circulation newspaper, which got hold of the email, he said, I don't see anything racially offensive in it. I just thought it was funny. Only after black lawmakers held a news conference and demanded an inquiry did Burnett apologize. As a trial judge, Burnett was to be impartial arbiter on matters of law, a role that evolved in the 17th and 18th centuries when judges were responsible for adducing the facts of a case, examining and cross-examining witnesses for the prosecution and defense. Today, judges in most European countries, except for Britain, supervise investigations, gather facts and evidence, and examine witnesses. An American judge may overturn a jury's finding of guilty if he deems the evidence does not support the verdict, but he may not find a defendant guilty if the jury has returned a not guilty verdict. At the time of Elmore's trial, Burnett had been a trial judge for only 7 months, and this was his first capital case. The two best criminal defense lawyers in Greenwood were James Bradford and Roush Wise, both in their early 30s. Wise could not represent Elmore because he had a conflict. The victim's daughter, Carolyn, had once worked for his law partner. And besides, he and Bradford had just finished a capital trial and were not emotionally or financially ready to take on another. Therefore, the public defender became Elmore's lead lawyer. Geddes Dowling Anderson was a lanky 6'4" swashbuckler with a smart mustache and a fondness for Panama hats. Some thought he looked like Gregory Peck, or was even more handsome. Most good trial lawyers have a bit of actor in them, and while a student at the University of South Carolina, where he enrolled after being tossed out of Clemson, he performed the lead male role in Bus Stop, playing Bo Decker, the cowboy who chases Cherry, played by Marilyn Monroe in the film version. Bitten by the acting bug, he dropped out of school and headed to Hollywood, driving day and night across the country in a 1950 Ford. He studied at the Pasadena Playhouse, got bit parts in the ABC series Bronco, and befriended the musician David Crosby, who had yet to team up with Stephen Stills and Graham Nash. After a year and a half, Anderson returned to South Carolina and tried again at Clemson, where a brother Joe was now the star quarterback. Geddes didn't excel at anything except maybe partying, and he was 32 before he finally managed to complete law school at the University of South Carolina. By his own account, he should have stayed in California. Many years later, sitting in his office with threadbare carpet, he said, I probably would have been a lot happier, as well as a hell of a lot more successful. Creditors and the IRS seemed to knock on his office door more than clients did. He sought the public defender job, which would guarantee him a steady income of $12,000 a year. Anderson was as affable as they come, and in truth, he was pretty good in the courtroom, when he was sober. Around town, bartenders called him the Bourbon Cowboy. They were sure that they had seen him on television as the Marlboro Man. They really hadn't. He was busted twice for drunk driving, once while he was the public defender, which caused some of the cops to laughingly wonder what it would be like for a prisoner to find himself sharing a cell with Anderson. During the trial, Elmore smelled alcohol on Anderson's breath every day, and his behavior in the courtroom reinforced the suspicion that he had been drinking when he should have been preparing. Anderson insists he was perfectly sober throughout the trial. He said, "I wasn't even hungover one day." Sled investigator Tom Henderson scoffed at that. He said, "Geddes Anderson was drunk through the whole trial." Under South Carolina law, because Elmore was facing a possible death sentence, he had to have two lawyers, a requirement in most death penalty states. Finding a second chair for Elmore wasn't easy. There were some 30 lawyers in Greenwood, all white and male, save for Solicitor Jones's daughter Selma. None rushed to take the case of a black man accused of killing a prominent white woman. When the town's lawyers realized the court was going to appoint one of them, they raised $5,000, which they offered to any lawyer who would take the case. It was kind of like buying your way out of the military during the Civil War. John Beasley stepped forward. He was an undistinguished criminal defense lawyer, known around town for boasting that he really didn't care much for work. Saturday was his favorite day of the week, he would tell friends. He liked it so much he got up earlier that day, he said. His father, Hugh, the county prosecutor for the 26 years before Jones took over, was a staunch segregationist and routinely used the word N to describe the black people. His son was more guarded, but he once slipped, referring to Elmore as a red-headed N. Anderson and Beasley couldn't comprehend Elmore. He was courteous and polite, but he was so uncommunicative. He wasn't like other men Anderson had defended who would scream, "I didn't do it, I didn't do it, here's what happened." Elmore just quietly kept saying he hadn't killed Mrs. Edwards. Anderson never considered that Elmore's reticence, his inability to articulate what happened, might reflect his mental limitations. Even less did he imagine that perhaps Elmore was telling the truth, that he was indeed innocent. Years after the trial, Anderson said, "In my judgment, that SOB did it. I was convinced of that all the time, and I still am." Nonetheless, Anderson had an ethical obligation to defend Elmore vigorously. Even if he puts no witnesses on the stand and presents no evidence, a defense lawyer in a criminal trial must test the state's case, require it to prove the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The obligations of the defense counsel and prosecutor are notably different. The prosecutor must be dedicated to making the criminal trial a procedure for the ascertainment of the true facts surrounding the commission of the crime. Justice Byron White wrote that in 1967 in the trial of United States versus Wade. But White also said, "But defense counsel has no comparable obligation to ascertain or present the truth." He said, "Our system assigns him a different mission. He must be and is interested in preventing the conviction of the innocent. But absent a voluntary plea of guilty, we also insist that he defend his client whether he is innocent or guilty. Ethical restraints that operate on the prosecution do not apply to the defense counsel. He need turn over nothing to the state that will help the state's case, while the prosecution is required to turn over all evidence to the defense. During cross-examination, a prosecutor is not supposed to seek to undermine a witness who he knows is telling the truth. A defense lawyer may. As part of the duty imposed on the most honorable defense counsel, we countenance or require conduct which in many instances has little, if any, relation to the search for truth," Justice White wrote. In capital cases, the obligation of the defendant's lawyer is even greater. While defense counsel has the obligation to render effective quality representation in all criminal cases, defense counsel in a capital case must, given this extraordinary penalty, make extraordinary efforts on behalf of the accused. That's what the ABA says in its criminal justice standards. With his client's life at stake, defense counsel should endeavor, within the bounds of law and ethics, to leave no stone unturned in the investigation and defense of a capital client. Anderson and Beasley did virtually nothing. They consulted no independent experts, no pathologists, no fingerprint specialists. They didn't search for witnesses, didn't talk to any of Mrs. Edwards's neighbors, didn't interview Mr. Holloway, who had found the body. They didn't even read the police interviews with the witnesses, which the prosecution had turned over to them as required by law. Ever since the time that defense lawyers first began to appear in criminal cases under English common law, their obligation has been to force the state to prove its case. Anderson and Beasley accepted the state's case more than they challenged it. They stipulated to the admissibility into evidence everything Jones wanted to introduce: hair, fingerprints, Elmore's blue jeans and coat, 98 items altogether. This meant that Jones didn't have to establish the chain of custody, that is, who had had possession of each item and where it had been, in order to rebut any chances of tampering. Anderson explained, "I have respect for the SLED team, and they're the best we have in South Carolina, and I assumed they were not going to contaminate the evidence." With the Sixth Amendment, the Founding Fathers guaranteed an accused the right to trial by an impartial jury, and in 1968 the Supreme Court said this right applied to cases in state courts as well. The guarantees of a jury trial in the federal and state constitutions reflect a profound judgment about the way in which law should be enforced and justice administered. Justice White explained in Duncan v. Louisiana, which held that even if a person was charged with only a misdemeanor, he had the right to a jury trial if he wanted one. The Constitution says nothing about how an impartial jury is to be selected. It's the judge's responsibility to ensure an unbiased jury, and he is helped in getting one through a process known to lawyers as voir dire. The judge, prosecutor, and defense counsel question the men and women who have been summoned for jury duty. Many questions are routine. Do you know of any? The police, the prosecutor, the defense counsel. Have you heard anything about the case that would prejudice you in reaching a verdict? And how do you feel about capital punishment? Jones and Anderson also ask members of the jury pool about their religious affiliations and views. Did they go to church? If so, which one? How did they feel about the biblical axiom of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth? Or were they more New Testament, prone to turning the other cheek? Solicitor Jones was a member of the same Episcopal church as Dorothy Edwards, but he wasn't looking for Episcopalians because their church is opposed to the death penalty. Jones wanted Southern Baptists, members of the most conservative church in a conservative region, among the staunchest believers in capital punishment. Get more than 4 Southern Baptists on the jury, and once your client is convicted, he's doomed to be sentenced to die, so-called death penalty lawyers say. Whites tend to support the death penalty more than blacks, men more than women, married persons more than singles, wealthy people more than poor people, suburbanites more than urbanites. And individuals who believe in capital punishment are generally more inclined to convict, to believe the police and the prosecutor. Frances Carolyn Mann was the first member of the panel to be questioned. She fit the profile of a pro-prosecution juror, 9th grade education, owned several guns, a stainless steel .357 Magnum, an Ithaca riot gun, a .22 Magnum, and a .25 automatic. Her current husband ran the Central Detective and Security Agency. Anderson asked her, "Mrs. Mann, I don't want to embarrass you, but isn't it a fact that your husband has a pending indictment against him in this court?" She said, "Yes, sir, he does." Anderson asked Judge Burnett to disqualify her. Anderson said, "She doesn't want to have him on her husband, I can tell you that." He was referring to Jones. Burnett disagreed. She could sit. The law gives the prosecution and defense peremptory challenges the right to dismiss a potential juror without giving any reason. In South Carolina at the time, Anderson had 10. He exercised his first to dismiss Mrs. Mann. He used his second and third against the next two on the panel. And then came Elizabeth Pinson, 55 years old. Judge Burnett asked her, "Have you formed an opinion about this case?" She said just about everyone had. It was a revealing observation about the press coverage of the murder and the chances of Elmore getting a fair trial. More candor and insight followed. "Do you feel like you could give Edward Lee Elmore a fair and impartial trial?" Beasley asked her. She said, "I feel that I have an obligation to the people that I know real well who are terrified because of this, and I think if I were on the jury, they would expect me to feel for all of them who were close to her and who saw the situation and who and whose lives did change because of this." "And did she believe in an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth?" Beasley asked her. She said, "I'm not a vindictive person, but I feel some obligation to the little old ladies of the community." Beasley argued to Judge Burnett that given these views, Mrs. Pinson could hardly be a fair and impartial juror, and asked that she be disqualified. Burnett declined to do so. Beasley exercised another peremptory challenge. The defense had only one left when Joseph Chalmers was called. He looked like a good juror for the defense. Methodist, one of the most educated members of the jury pool, with a B.S. in industrial engineering from Clemson, 49. He lived in the fashionable Belmead neighborhood, a couple of miles from Melrose Terrace. Anderson asked him if he had read about the case. "Yes," he said. "And had that caused him to form an opinion?" And his answer reinforced what Mrs. Pinson had said. He said, "Well, the newspapers pretty much put the facts on you that they had found the guilty person, and certainly I went ahead and believed that." But still, Anderson accepted Chalmers for the jury. By virtue of his education and religion, he might vote for a life sentence rather than execution. Chalmers was sent off to wait while the jury selection continued. The process of selecting a jury had already been long and taxing when 47-year-old Augustus Covington was called. "Would you be prejudiced against the state of South Carolina or the solicitor because they ask for the death penalty?" Judge Burnett had asked this of Covington, as he had other potential jurors, and Covington answered, "I wouldn't be prejudiced, but I don't approve of no death penalty." Burnett said, "You do not approve of the death penalty?" Covington answered with a shake of his head. "My religion teach me, the Bible says, thou shalt not kill." Mere opposition to the death penalty wasn't enough by itself to disqualify Covington from serving. In a landmark case, Witherspoon versus Illinois, the U.S. Supreme Court held that an Illinois statute allowing the prosecution to remove a potential juror who had conscientious scruples against capital punishment was unconstitutional. And with that, our time has escaped us once again. I'm reading Anatomy of Injustice, written by Raymond Bonner and published by Alfred A. Knopf of New York in the year 2012. Funding for this program, made possible by this and other National Public Radio stations, broadcast and streaming rights given to us by the publisher. Till next time, from Michigan State, this is Dick Estelle.